Well, this morning we have the privilege of having with us Dr. Robert Carter, and it is a little bit different format. Actually, when I get an opportunity to teach different places, that I teach off my laptop as well, but I don't think I've ever seen a laptop here on our pulpit. So a little bit different this morning, but why are we doing this? What's going on here this morning? Well, I don't know if you know this or are aware of this. I was just made aware of this just this last year. But this week, particularly February 12th, is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. And in fact, this year also marks the 150th anniversary of his publication of On an Origin of Species that he published in 1859. And perhaps unbeknownst to you and unbeknownst to me, just even as of last year, there are all kinds of celebrations planned really throughout the world. Just give you an example. At Cambridge, I was looking on the internet just last night, and they have the 200th anniversary festival that basically throughout the entire month of February and throughout the year, they're having all kinds of different events. They're having a voyage of Charles Darwin, a kind of a one-man play enacting his famous voyage. They're having special movies and then Q&A regarding evolution. They're having talks and workshops, exhibitions, tours. There's school field trips celebrating this particular festival. There's even the young Darwin poets, 14 to 16-year-old boys and girls who are spending a couple days of lectures. This actually was in October, but it's continuing throughout this year, where they're going to creative writing workshops after seeing different kinds of films and different speakers on the topic of evolution. They even have hired Cambridge, a PR agency, to promote the events. They're organizing all kinds of committees, all kinds of festival boards. There's even a Darwin photo competition on February 12th. The Royal Mail is issuing 10 new Darwin stamps. According to one website, there are currently 535 events scheduled in 39 countries for Darwin Day 2009. There was even a big clock counting down the days, the hours, and the minutes to Darwin Day. Well, obviously, these are individuals who are celebrating a man who was a very intelligent individual who wrote a book that really has influenced our world in a very significant way. We thought here at Sovereign Grace Community Church this would be an opportunity for us in the midst of all this going on in this special month of February that we would be able to have someone come and speak and help equip us with those things, perhaps as the title of the message today of Dr. Carter's message is what Darwin didn't know. Because I think many times as Christians, we're frightened or even feel inferior, somehow that we're overmatched and somehow that we are intellectually inferior. But one of the neat things about Jesus Christ, he didn't just say that I've given you truth. He said this, I am truth. All truth emanates from Him. And we have that truth. Not only do we have that truth, but if you are in Christ this morning, if you've repented from your sins and trusted in the work, the sacrificial death of Jesus Christ, you have that one living within you. And so we ask Dr. Carter to come and to speak. Dr. Carter is a graduate of both Georgia Tech, later got his PhD in marine biology from the University of Miami. In between that time, he was a teacher, a high school teacher, taught physics and chemistry, biology, and electronics. And after which, he is now the head speaker and head scientist of Creation Ministries International, which is really a ministry that exists really to proclaim the gospel, but to specifically address these topics, like the one that we're going to be looking at this morning together. Dr. Carter is here with his wife, Leanne, and their three children, and so he will be speaking I think, throughout this next week, I don't know, I didn't count the number of times, but it's numerous different places pretty close by. So if that's something that you'd be interested to hear in different topics, perhaps you can talk to Dr. Carter afterward and just hook up with him, ask him where he's going to be. Perhaps you want to be a part of that. So I would recommend that. As well, we have the bookstore. Our bookstore is over here in the corner, but there's special books there. A lot of the resources that Dr. Carter is going to be mentioning, perhaps even this morning, that you can go and want to just encourage you to just to arm yourself and to inform yourself about this important topic. I just met Dr. Carter yesterday. So this is something very new for me, because I take very seriously Sunday morning. Why? Well, these are God's people. And these are people that God sent His Son for, bled for, died for. And I know that someday that I'm going to stand before Christ and give an account for how I cared, nurtured, protected, instructed, and all those many things of God's flock. But I think, boy, this is really an important issue. And I want to be able to help you, to equip you, and to enable you to be able to engage with the world in a way that's important. And if just reading that, just that small litany of those different activities across the whole world, it is really a big deal. It really is. And I think as Christians, and that's important, that we be able to interact and engage our culture. And so that's why we're doing this here this morning. We want to be able to grow in our understanding of God's Word first and foremost. We want to understand the Gospel, and then we want to live the Gospel. That's important. But we also, it's also important for us to be able to know what's going on and to be able to interact with different individuals. And so, Dr. Carter, I'm so grateful that you're here. Looking forward to hear you speak. And if I could just tell just a short anecdote, if you want to make your way up, that way I know you're anxious to get going and we're anxious to hear you as well. But I wish you could have been there with me at lunchtime as Dr. Carter just began taking just objects like this water and this glass, and he began just putting the cookies on the lower shelf for someone like me to be able to explain. And he took out a napkin and began drawing graphs. And I like graphs. They speak to me. But why do I share that? This is why I share that. I share that because it was evident as he was talking, he was passionate about the truth. He was passionate about living his life in such a way to bring honor to Jesus Christ. And to do it in a community of scientists, but also to be able to help and equip you and me. To be able to put cookies on the lower shelf, that we would be able to interact with individuals, that we would be able to see that our faith is secure in Jesus Christ. And God has given us the answers, because He's given us His Son. But it was just so neat to see your passion, and I so appreciate the time that we spent together, and we look forward to hearing from you this morning. So, church, can we please welcome Dr. Carter?
What can I say after that except all shucks? You know, I speak at a lot of different churches, all different denominations all over the country. And this has been a very refreshing yesterday and today. I've met a lot of really fine people. I really enjoyed singing at the top of my voice over here. But singing at the top of your lungs is not really good if you're going to go out and speak for a little while afterwards. So bear with me. It was a lot of fun. This is a really good group of people. You've got something special here, and I hope you understand that. I'm going to talk this morning. It's going to be a history lesson. I think a fun history lesson. I'm going to talk about a man named Charles Darwin. I am not going to tear him to shreds. I'm going to give him credit for some things that he did that he deserves credit for. But I'm going to point out some of his errors. There's an old adage, you know thine enemy. Charles Darwin stood before he died, directly opposed to everything that I believe. At the end of this, I hope you understand, his biggest contribution to the world was atheism, not science. That's going to be my end point. I just told you what it is. Remember last night I talked a lot about Creation Magazine. I'm not going to talk about it nearly as much this morning because I want to get through Charles Darwin. I don't have time to plug this magazine. I gave you my testimony about it. I hope you heard it. A lot of you signed up for it. Thank you very, very much. If I pique your curiosity and you're interested in something, there is a sign-up thing on the book tables. It looks like this, and you can sign up for Creation Magazine. You might be interested in it. I'll tell you that it's $25 a year. So please forgive me for bringing up money in on a Sunday morning. It makes me really uncomfortable. But it's $25 a year. I'll give you a free one. And if you sign up for a 3-year subscription, I'll give you a free DVD. It's normally $13. Okay? These are brand new, by the way. I haven't even seen them. We just got them from Canada. Some of our Canadian office, they put down what I think are going to be 4 really good DVDs. But I can't tell you how good they are because I don't know. Also, I don't want to pass around these clipboards again because we did it last night, but if you didn't get a chance to sign up for our InfoBytes email newsletter, this a sign-up sheet just like this is sitting on the book tables also. Now, all the people that came out of marketing in my organization would tell me that what I just did was very foolish because no one's going to sign up. We'll see. I would also point you to our Creation Answers book, probably the most read book on the subject because it has answers. And I would point you to our website, creation.com. Now, I talked a lot last night. I'm not going to go into any more. Now, here's something I want to introduce. This is a big year for Charles Darwin. In fact, that list that was just read, I didn't know most of that. That was pretty amazing. CMI, knowing that this is going to be a big year, we decided to go way out on a limb. And we spent $750,000 filming high-def documentary on Charles Darwin, which included trips to the Galapagos Islands and trips all over South America and historical reenactments on a real wooden ship with real actors. And we hired a real producer and a real sound man and a real cameraman who worked in the industry, even though they're Christians. They work for the Discovery Channel and History Channel. And we put together, I've seen this, I got to see it last month, this is a world-class publication. We are talking with various networks trying to get it on the air. It is not a Christian piece. It is neutral, or as neutral as we could make it. The whole goal of our Darwin film, I can't tell you the title yet because it hasn't actually come out yet, but the whole goal is to raise questions in people's minds. So it's designed to be shown to a group of people, Christians or not, and simply make them say, huh, I didn't know that. Because that's the first step in getting Darwin out of your mind. And I think it's going to have a huge impact. A lot of my talk this morning comes out of preparation for this movie. What Darwin didn't know. It's a good question. Because back in the 1800s, they didn't know a lot of things we knew today. At the end, I'm going to ask the question, if Darwin were alive today, would he invent evolution as a theory? First, I said this last night, we want to reach our culture. We have to give them alternative to the evolutionary theory that's in their mind. And we have this commandment from 1 Peter 3:15, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that's within you with meekness and fear. Everybody okay so far? You like that admonition? Well, let's get ready to give an answer to Charles Darwin. This is fun. 3 things he didn't know. Modern geology. Modern biology, especially modern genetics. And he most certainly did not ever know Jesus. And that's critical. This man, Charles Darwin, started off being the son of a rather wealthy doctor. And the grandson of Josiah Wedgwood, you women who got married at one point in time, no doubt many of you looked at Wedgwood pottery or Wedgwood china. That is Charles Darwin's grandfather, Mr. Wedgwood. He also married a Wedgwood. His cousin, his first cousin, was his wife, who was also descended from this man. So they were actually very well-to-do. So his father sent him to study medicine at Edinburgh, and he didn't survive more than 2 years there, especially after his brother left. So he quit and went and shot quail for an entire summer. And his father said, "Son, we got to do something with you." So he sent him to study theology at Cambridge. Now, Edinburgh and Cambridge are the two best universities in the world, if you live in the British Isles anyway. And most people outside the British Isles would think the same thing. So Charles Darwin goes and he studies theology to become an Anglican minister. Strange. When he graduates, he calls himself a geologist. How can that be? Well, the answer is he's a Victorian gentleman. He is expected to have a grasp on a wide diversity of subjects. Part of the liberal arts tradition that we get from England is to expose people to a lot of different subjects. And back then, a lot of science was really in its nascent stage. You could become an expert in several different fields of science all at the same time. So he became a geologist. What's a geologist doing writing the biggest, most important book of biology in all time? Good question. Because it's the geology that led to the biology. So this man has two tutors. First one is a man named Adam Sedgwick. Now Sedgwick was a very, very, very important geologist. You remember last night I showed you the picture of the jellyfish. I said it's 500 million years old. In quotes. And I went through the progression thing. And I said it didn't change after all this time. And it was from the dawn of multicellular life. Well, that jellyfish was from the Cambrian era, named after the ancient name for whales, Cambria, where Adam Sedgwick toured. In fact, Charles Darwin spent an entire summer with Sedgwick touring around Wales while Sedgwick was figuring out the Cambrian era, which is the so-called earliest fossil rocks that contain living organisms, the Cambrian. Well, Sedgwick was a Christian, but he was not a biblical creationist. And he was, in fact, an old-age catastrophist, as in the Earth is millions of years old and various catastrophes have occurred during Earth's history that has produced a fossil record. Well, this is almost demonstrably false. And so Sedgwick gave Darwin a falsifiable geology, and he didn't give him any love for the Scriptures. So when the next man to come along to influence Charles Darwin, he just sucked it right in. This man was named Charles Lyell. Now, Charles Lyell was not a Christian. He was not a biblical creationist. He was not a catastrophist. He gave us the phrase, "The present is the key to the past." That is a critical phrase because that is what modern science is based on, or modern inference in science is based on. All of evolutionary theory is the assumption, the worldview assumption, that natural processes can explain everything. And this man is a key to understanding that. The present is the key to the past. So in Lyell's geology, everything is slow and gradual. There's no room for catastrophe. So when Charles Lyell went to this island in the Galapagos, I've been here. We didn't get to land because it's vertical cliffs for 200 feet. What is that? What is that island made of? Why is it in a circle? It's a volcano, right? But notice on the southern end is very heavily eroded. Because the prevailing winds and the prevailing rains and the prevailing currents in the Galapagos Island all come from the south. So all the hills in the Galapagos are sloped from the north and they slope down as they go to the south. And so Darwin saw this and he said, "Oh, millions of years. Slow and gradual." With the assumption that it hardly ever rains in the Galapagos Islands, which is true. But you know, one big rainstorm can cause 10,000 years of erosion. You see how slow and gradual has some problems? He also went to this place. Actually, he didn't get this far. He went to the river valley south or downstream of this glacier. This is the Perito Moreno Glacier in Argentina. We sent a crew here. And they filmed this glacier. A creationist just last year went and found Darwin's campsite downstream of the glacier. And he found where Darwin was and that what Darwin measured and what Darwin described. And he found out that Darwin was flat wrong with what he concluded. You see, Darwin went all over the world and he took Lyell's geology, slow and gradual, and he used it to explain this and explain that and explain this. And he explained this river valley caused by the ocean carving the basalt, hard basalt rocks, carving the cliffs. completely ignored the fact, because he didn't know it, that there was a glacier upstream. And the river valley was really caused by a catastrophic flood from a pent-up lake behind the glacier, and the glacier broke. And the river flood was so strong, it was 6 miles wide and hundreds of feet deep, and it carved the entire river valley in one big wash. That's what we know now. But he could not accept that because he couldn't accept catastrophe. Something else Charles Darwin didn't know. He knew nothing about plate tectonics. Now, do I know anything about plate tectonics? Not really. I studied it a lot. I don't know if it's true or not. But all of modern geology is based on plate tectonics. Everything. In Lyell's view, continents slowly rose and slowly sank. In plate tectonics view, continents move sideways. So everything Darwin wrote about geology was wrong. And he wrote more about geology than biology. And his biology is based on his geology. Do you see the weak link? He knew nothing about how sediments form. Have you ever gone out to a street after a rainstorm and looked in the gutter and seen clay or little fine-grained sand, just, you know, ribbons on the side of the road? You realize that's not supposed to happen, because fine particles aren't supposed to settle out of water while water's flowing. But every school kid in the world knows that fine particles settle out of water while it's flowing. Just the geologists didn't know that. Until, literally, 2007, McQuaker and Bohax wrote a paper called On the Accumulation of Mud. Appeared in Science magazine, one of the top journals in the entire world, and this one paper completely overturns 150 years of speculating. We've been told all this time that when you see the White Cliffs of Dover, when you see a sedimentary accumulation of fine particles, that it takes millions of years for these things to accumulate. They're little critters that live in the ocean. They have little shells, little calcium carbonate shells. And when they die, the little shell sloughs off. It can literally take 100 years for that little shell to sink from the surface of the ocean to the bottom of the ocean. They're so small that movements of water molecules make them jiggle. So, 100 years to sink. And so when you look at something that's composed of these shells that's 100 feet thick, you say, oh, it must take millions of years to accumulate this. Not anymore. Not after this, because we now know that stuff, as water's flowing sideways, it causes turbulence. The turbulence makes those little things flock together and fall out like they're rocks. 150 years they've been wrong, and people their faith has been shattered time and time again by evolutionary arguments that aren't true. Now, they could have asked a creationist this a long time ago. This is a creationist guy, Berthold, who's doing work. He takes a mixture of white and black sand, and the white and black sand has different densities, and he mixes it up and it's gray, and he pours it in that left side. He just pours it into a graduated cylinder and spontaneously separates into white and black bands. And then he's got a flume. You see on the bottom right here, there's a channel about this wide, 20 feet long or so. And there's water flowing through it. And he's dumping this gray sand into this end of it. And the water's flowing. The sand's falling out thing. And you can see from the side view up in the top right, it spontaneously falls out of the water in white and black stripes. And the reason that it's not, it goes from white, black, to black, to white, to black, you know, it's all those variations, because he's changing the water flow. The speed of the water dictates what that looks like. And then if you take a cross-section of it, like this bottom one, you can see all these laminations. That is not caused by this year after year after year after year. It's caused by sand flowing in water sideways. And that's what we see in the fossil record all over the world. The evolutionists couldn't handle that. This is 10-year-old information. It's taken them 10 years before they dare to start publishing their own stuff that's basically saying what this creationist said a long time ago. So we see stuff like this. I showed you this last night. This is not year after year after year accumulation. This is an ashfall that formed in a matter of hours from downstream or downhill from Mount St. Helens. Because it's really kind of funny. There are a lot of evolutionists now who are becoming catastrophists, like Sedgwick, the old age catastrophists. They believe in millions of years. And they'll be like, oh, catastrophe did that, and the catastrophe did that, but there's millions of years in between them. But they're becoming catastrophists because they can't wither the blast that the creationists are giving them, because our model works so much better. Okay, geology. Clear your mind a second. Relax. I know geology stuff. Let's talk about biology now. Let me ask you a question. What is evolution? See, I'm a biologist, but I'm not an evolutionist. I know all this stuff. I don't know everything. But I mean, I read all the books that everyone else reads, all the same kind of information, and I'm still not an evolutionist. Why? Because evolution takes a worldview, the worldview called naturalism. The idea that natural processes can explain everything. If you take the study of life and put the assumption that natural processes can explain it, you get evolution. If you take the study of life and put the assumption that God created it, you get creationism. You see the difference? Same life, same study. First and foremost, you know, back in the 1800s, it's really kind of funny what people believed about stuff. It's funny to us because you look at it, it's like, man, that was awfully naive. But you got to give them credit, on the other hand, because they were figuring it out. We know it because they figured it out. But back in Darwin's day, you know, you're made up of cells, right? Little teeny little thing, a couple trillion cells that make up your body. Well, they thought the cell was just a bag of salt. And so if one cell turned purple, well, that's easy to explain. If one cell made a square, and one cell was circle, and one cell changed to be pointy, well, then you could explain evolution. They knew nothing about what was inside the cell, which today we know is a factory more complex than a city. In fact, if you took Washington, D.C., maybe that's not a good example. Too much waste in Washington, D.C. If you took, I don't know, New York City, and you figured out what everyone in that city does, you could draw a correlation between the city and the cell, from the garbage collector to the manufacturer to the data storage people. It's unbelievable. More complex than any city, but it's a city that can reproduce itself in 5 minutes. Mind-boggling complex. I'm going to show you a complicated picture. Relax. This is a fun picture, even though it looks complicated. It's not complicated. Each of these, this is a picture here of the yellow, the blue, and the green. Each dot in the picture is a protein found in the fruit fly. Simple little fruit flies. The green area, that shows proteins that are found inside the cell. The blue area is proteins that are found in the cell membrane. And the yellow area is proteins that are found outside the cell, either attached to the cell or free floating. Okay? Each of the lines connecting each of the dots shows that this protein interacts with that protein. And so if you take that square and zoom up, and take the other square and zoom up again, you can see that just white and green dots. And yet, there's an unbelievable amount of connecting lines. Some of those dots connect to 7 different proteins. So protein number 1 interacts physically with 7 different proteins. They have to fit together. If you break any one of those links, out of all of those links, the animal will probably die. How did it arise from spontaneous natural processes? How do you take an unbelievably complex system where if you tweak it a little bit, you kill the animal, and you say that it was created from little tweakings? You can't do it. Because any previous stage is also going to be complicated. If you tweak it, you kill it. And yet you had 10 million tweaks to make a fruit fly out of a roundworm or something like that? Charles Darwin's theory depended upon life being simple. And the more complex life gets, the more untenable evolution becomes. And it's getting worse and worse and worse for them. Now, this is only 2,300 proteins out of the 7,000 they found. The human body produces 100,000 different proteins. Of all that, they can't do it. And they know it. And they don't know what the answer is. Darwin also didn't know how fast species can form. You know, his old slow and gradual thing. Well, today we know this is not true. It's a fantastic book. Very well written. I read this back in 95. Won the Pulitzer Prize, called The Beak of the Finch. It was a story about these two, and I've met these people. They're delightful evolutionists. Lovely people. Wonderful. You sit and have tea with them and talk to them for hours. I sat on a plane next to them by accident. As we were flying to the Galapagos Islands after they told us they wouldn't give us their interview. Hey, pass a little note to the producer sitting in front of me. Guess who just sat down next to me? What do you know? So they gave us the interview. And then they declined to be in the final production. So. That's all right. That's just fine. The movie's great without them. Anyway, they've been studying on this little teeny volcanic island, about 30 acres, for 30 years. And every year they go there and they catch all the birds. And they weigh them, and they measure their beaks, and they put a little tag on their leg. So for 30 years, they know the genealogy of just about every bird. That's a lot of work. Well, lo and behold, would you be shocked? They discovered that two different species of birds during dry years become one species of bird during wet years. Because during a wet year, there's seeds everywhere, tons of food. So your average generic bird can live just fine. But in the dry years, it's the birds with the middle-sized beaks that don't do very well. The ones with the big beaks can crack the big opuntia cactus seeds. The ones with the little beaks, they can find the seeds in between rocks. But the ones in the middle, they can't do either, and they die. 1 year, two species. During the La Nina years. And then when El Nino comes, and all those rain dumps on the islands, everything turns green, those two so-called species re-interbreed again, become one species again. Do you understand how un-Darwin that is? Well, they wrote a book. It's actually the creationist essay on speciation coming out from the evolutionists, How and Why Species Multiply, where they document their 30 years of work. I'm stunned. I don't know what to say at this point other than they did our work for us. Because we always believe the species change quickly. We never believe in fixity of species. That's like saying that people believe the earth was flat. You know that was invented by Washington Irving, the novelist, in his novel on Columbus. No one believed the earth was flat. Everyone since ancient times knew the earth was a sphere. Anyway. Darwin also didn't know how species can interbreed. I talked about the finches. Well, here's another one. Here is, on the left, a marine iguana. Imps of darkness, Charles Darwin called them. Ugliest critter you could ever see. They don't live in water. They only eat seaweed. They don't drink fresh water. They've got a salt problem because there should be land animals. And so they have salt glands in their nose. And when you watch them, they go... and pew! Two little salt snots get flown out of their nose. And they do it all day long. They blow salt out of their nose. The land iguana on the right never goes in water. You couldn't make it go in water. It will eat you before you throw it into the water, even though they don't eat people. They sit around on land, and they sit underneath the cactus, and they wait for something to fall. And then they eat it. And then they wait. They get a very boring life. These species have supposedly been separated for 3 million years. Supposedly. Now, there hasn't been 3 million years in the history of the Earth to do this, but the evolutionists say 3 million years. To put that in perspective, that's how long humans and chimpanzees have been separated. So you wouldn't expect the land iguana and the marine iguana to be able to hybridize, right? So imagine their shock the first time anyone went out and looked. Bing, 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 bing. Oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. Oops. We have the director of the Charles Darwin Research Center on camera in our video saying, "We were shocked when we found that." Because his worldview prevented him from ever thinking that these things could hybridize. This thing is now about 15 years old. They don't know if it's a boy or a girl. 15 years old is the reproductive... this thing is now at reproductive age. I think there are three of them still alive in this little teeny island where this grad student went out to look for them. Well, I found them as soon as I started looking. We don't know if it's going to breed with land iguanas or marine iguanas. I bet land iguanas. But nobody knows. Blurring the species lines. Let's put this in perspective. Up on the top photo is a picture of what happens when you take a wolf and breed it with a regular dog. Well, you kind of get half dog, half wolf looking things and are kind of mean. But if you breed them together, the grand puppies can look like anything. There's a mutt, a lab, a wolf, and a shaggy DA, sheepdog. If you breed wolves and dogs, you have created the genetic capacity to make a lot of different breeds of dogs. If you inbreed them again, wolves and dogs are the same species. On the bottom left is what is called a Sulamov dog. You might not have ever heard of them. If you ever go through the Moscow airport with drugs in your bag, no doubt you will meet a Sulamov dog. Because they use these in the Moscow airport to sniff for drugs. Now the Russians, they said, you know, huskies are great cold weather dogs, but they can't smell very well because why do you need to smell well when it's 20 below outside? Your nose would freeze off, so they don't have good smelling apparatuses. But they needed a good smelling dog to work in Moscow in the wintertime. So they did something kind of silly. They took huskies and bred them with African jackals. African jackals can smell really, really well, but jackals? That's not a dog. Well, it turns out it was a dog. And they got half husky, half jackal hybrids, which were very mean. So they said, well, this isn't any good. So they bred them into huskies again. And a Sulamov dog is one quarter African jackal. Three quarters husky. They smell very, very well, even in the cold. Coyote dogs or koi dogs are very common. Wolf dogs are so common that someone wrote a book, Living with Wolf Dogs. If I wrote that book, I'd make it one page. Not recommended. Here's a funny one. Darwin, the father of evolution, missed it. When I was getting ready to go to the Galapagos, I was doing a lot of research, and I was spending a lot of time on the web, and I must have gone to 100 different websites about the Galapagos Islands. Without exception, every single website said, while on the Galapagos Islands, Charles Darwin came up with the theory of natural selection. Anyone ever heard something like that before? If I asked you, when did Darwin invent natural selection, would any of you have said, oh, on the Galapagos Islands? Every website said it. It is an absolute fabrication. A complete mistake. I'm not going to say lie because I don't think most people realize it's a mistake. But the people at the top of science, they know it, but they don't correct the people below them who are writing all these websites and books and articles. It's really frustrating because it's flat out wrong. Darwin himself, in his own journal, said, "It never occurred to me that the productions of islands, or the different species found on islands, only a few miles apart, placed under the same physical conditions, would be dissimilar. I therefore did not attempt to make a series of specimens from the separate islands." What he's saying is, he went to this island and that island over there, and he never thought there'd be different species on the islands. He just thought, oh, those are birds, those are turtles, those are lizards. The father of evolution did not see the icon of evolution when he saw it. He totally missed it. He collected a bunch of animals. He collected tons of birds, Darwin's finches. Those finches I showed you that those people studied, those are called Darwin's finches. He didn't know there were finches. He was collecting them. He was a geologist, remember? He was collecting them, and he bagged them up and sent them to the museum, the Natural History Museum in London, for someone else. He collected a bunch of lizards for someone else. He collected a bunch of bugs for someone else. He was just being a natural. He was collecting things to give to some of his friends for their enjoyment, so they could work science on them. He was a geologist. He studied rocks. And therefore, he collected a bird here and a bird there, and he never wrote what island they came from. Darwin's famous finches. They used the captain of the Beagle, who was in some sense a Christian, some sense a creationist. They used his bird collection to sort out Darwin's bird collection in order to give Darwin the credit. The term called hagiography, which I really don't understand, but a hagiography is basically a grand story you tell about someone, whether or not it's true. Oh, sorry, here's a picture of Darwin's finches. He didn't see them. How about this one? You see these two big turtles? What's different about them? The shells are different. This one has a saddle back. Looks like that saddle right behind his head. This one, this shell does that. The governor of the Galapagos Islands told Charles Darwin when he was touring the islands. He was only there for several weeks, about 6 weeks. His 5-year journey around the world, he spent almost all of his time in South America studying geology. A couple of weeks in the Galapagos Islands, they sailed to Tahiti, they sailed to Australia, and then he sailed home. Just put it in perspective. The governor of the islands told Charles Darwin, "Hey Charles, I can tell you what island any of these tortoises came from just by the shape of his shell." Charles wrote in his journal, "I did not believe him." Different perspective on the man, isn't it? Charles Darwin didn't know anything about modern genetics. And when modern genetics was starting to be invented, people hid it. He didn't know anything about the most complex storage mechanism in the universe, the DNA molecule. You know you have 3 feet of DNA inside each one of your trillions of microscopic cells in your body? This molecule is that long, twisted up into something you can't even see. And that little teeny molecule controls everything that makes you you. He knew nothing of it. When Gregor Mendel was sitting working with his pea plants in his monastery, he came up with the laws of genetics. And the textbooks will say, he wrote an obscure journal and people rediscovered him about 40 years later. It's not true. He wrote in a very well-read journal and everybody read his paper and said, "Oh, ain't gonna have any of that." And they suppressed it for 40 years. Because Charles Darwin talked about blending inheritance. Charles Darwin talked about mushy ideas of inheritance and how traits are infinitely variable. Mendel said, "Oh no, you're either purple or white. You're either smooth or wrinkled, green or not green." In the pea plants. And that didn't fit with Darwin. And so they hid him. And it wasn't until the fruit fly guys were working in the early 1900s where they invented this idea of mutation. They said, "Oh, mutations happen. Oh, let's resurrect Mendel now." And so what we have today, what people believe today, is called neo-Darwinism, new Darwinism. The neo-Darwinian synthesis is when they took Mendel and Darwin and blended them together in the 1900s. It took a long time. If they haven't discovered mutations, they might not be talking about Mendel today. Funny, Darwin didn't know anything about human migrations. This is something I've studied. In fact, I wrote a paper that got published in an evolutionary journal about mitochondrial Eve. You've heard the term mitochondrial Eve before? Well, I actually figured out part of Eve, like from the Bible Eve. I figured out part of her genetic sequence. by taking the average of all people in the world of that particular genetic sequence, and it was really easy to do. The evolutionists never would have thought it because they don't think Eve ever existed. Well, this is an evolutionary map of the Tower of Babel. Can I say that again? The evolutionists have discovered, even though they're trying to disprove it, they have discovered the story of the Tower of Babel in our genes. This is a map of the so-called Out of Africa event. But the starting point is an assumption. In fact, the starting point is not in Central Africa. According to their own work, it's in Ethiopia, up in the northeast corner by that M, put in the red part. Well, Ethiopia is right next to the Middle East. And genetically, you can't tell if the origin is in Ethiopia or in Mesopotamia. I mean, they're essentially the same area. And in Africa, if you just go westward and as you go southward in Africa, genetic diversity decreases as you get further away from the origin of the spread. Just like as you go north into Europe and east and south, genetic diversity decreases as you get further away from the original population, as smaller and smaller people groups migrate further and further and further and get all the way to the tip of South America. They're formed from smaller and smaller populations, and the genetic diversity decreases. In fact, tracking the mothers or the female lineage, this map is telling us that sometime in the recent past, people groups traveling in small tribes, moving into areas that were uninhabited, with three female founding lines, as in the three daughters-in-law of Noah, went through the Middle East. That's ours. Thank you very much, evolutionists, for finding all this information for us. This is exactly what we would expect if the Tower of Babel was true, and we can move that origin anywhere we want. And I've tried it. It works very nicely. We can explain the history of the world using Genesis, even from the evolutionist data. Okay. Remember Adam Sedgwick? Darwin's mentor? He didn't like what he read. He wrote to Darwin a letter. He said, "I've read your book with more pain than pleasure." Which, can you imagine your mentor telling you that? "Parts I read with absolute sorrow because I think them utterly false and grievously mischievous. You have deserted the true method of induction." He continues, now, Sedgwick here is talking about a link between the moral and the physical. Anyone who's my age remember that the album by the Police, Ghost in the Machine? You've heard philosophers talking about, is there a ghost in the machine? Well, they're arguing, are we just a mechanism or is there a spirit? For an evolutionist, you're just a machine. There's no spirit. Well, Sedgwick didn't believe that. He believed in the spiritual. And he said, were it possible, which thank God it is not, to break this link between the physical and spiritual, humanity in my mind would suffer damage that might brutalize it and sink the human race into a lower grade of degradation than any into which it has fallen, since his written records tell us of its history. Do you know what he was doing there? He was predicting the history of the 20th century. As soon as you remove that physical, that moral part of the physical, well, so what if Stalin killed 20 million people? They're just monkeys. Big deal if Pol Pot murdered half of Cambodia, if Mao killed who knows how many. They're just voices. There's no spirit to it. You see the implication? Charles Darwin also didn't know that people were going to publish his theory before him. He did know about his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. Erasmus Darwin wrote a book on evolution in the late 1700s. Strangely, it rhymed. Okay, but if you want to read a rhyming story on evolution, you can read Erasmus Darwin's kind of strange work. It's actually kind of interesting, but it's about evolution. I thought Darwin invented evolution. Actually, no, the ancient Greeks invented evolution. It's been around for a long time. In fact, the ancient Greeks probably didn't invent it. Probably comes from before them. There's another man named Edward Blythe. He's a very important figure. Edward Blythe, in 1825, called himself a Christian, called himself a creationist. Now, I'm not sure about his creationism. Later on, it gets kind of fuzzy, but okay, I'm not that man, and we don't have that much record about the guy. But 1825, this is when Charles Darwin got on the Beagle and sailed around the world. He gets to South America, and someone sends him a journal, and in that journal is Edward Blythe's paper on natural selection. What? The creationists invented the idea of natural selection? Yeah. But see, for Blythe, natural selection got rid of the less fit and preserved the species. It was God's culling mechanism to keep a species healthy. And it allowed a species to adapt to new environments. But Blythe never thought that it's utterly adaptable, like a microbe can evolve into anything else. He wouldn't have even said that cows could evolve into horses, or some primitive cow-horse thing could evolve into each other. But a creationist invented natural selection. That's 1825. We know Charles Darwin read this, because we have his copy. He wrote in the margins. Later on, a man named Alfred Russel Wallace, in 1857, 2 years before Charles Darwin published Origin of Species. Now, Wallace, poor guy, he wasn't rich. He was living in the Borneo area, traveling all around what we now call Indonesia and Malaysia, collecting birds and bugs and butterflies to send back to people in England for them to put on display. He made his trade as a collector. Well, as he's going around this region, he made some unbelievable ecological conclusions. Some things that even exist today that still hold that he was right about. And he came up with what Charles Darwin has been credited with, the idea of natural selection leading to the origin of species. As in, everything can be traced back to a common ancestor. This is Wallace. How come it's not called Wallacean evolution? Why is it Darwinian evolution? Probably because in class-conscious Victorian society, if you were a nobody, you didn't do anything important. So they give credit to Darwin. Oh, so I just said all that. That's a picture. He said, every species has come into existence, coincident in time and space with pre-existing species. Flowery language for evolution. Okay, my last little section. Charles Darwin didn't know Jesus. And I say that as a matter of fact. He was an atheist. There's no indication he ever accepted any of the basic biblical tenets. His mother and his wife are Unitarians. Now back then, that was before the Unitarians became the Unitarian Universalists that deny the Trinity and other things. But the Unitarians there, back in this time, they were a fringe group of Protestantism. His father and his grandfather weren't Christians. He called themselves freethinkers. Yeah, he went to school to train as an Anglican, but that doesn't mean anything. He called himself an agnostic, which was a polite term invented by Thomas Huxley, his great friend, called Darwin's bulldog. He invented that term because the word atheist was a little bit too unacceptable in his society, so agnostic. It's a very, very community say, well, I don't know if God exists or not. And that's what he hid behind. And very importantly, many of you in this room might have heard that Darwin recanted on his deathbed. I want to dispel that utterly from your mind. Please don't reiterate that. That's actually in our DVD and on our website, our article called Arguments That Creationists Should Not Use. Because it's not true. There's no evidence for it. The letter, the Lady Hope letter that was written, got a lot of significant facts about his death incorrect. And we have his letters right up to the day he died. And his letters have no indication whatsoever that he ever changed his mind. Okay? Charles Darwin writing in his autobiography, "Thus, disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress, and have never since doubted, even for a second, that my conclusion was correct. I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true. For if so, the plain language of the text seemed to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all of my friends, you're surrounded by non-Christians, will be everlastingly punished. And this is damnable doctrine. Imagine, I would ask Darwin, would you please define the word damnable, Mr. Darwin? Because he can't, because that's not his word, that's our word. But evolutionists are really good at taking our words and using them, where even in their own words, they have no way to define them. Continuing on, a man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God, or a future existence with retribution and reward, can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are the strongest or which seem to him the best ones. That's called hedonism, doing what you want. Charles Darwin knew this in the beginning. Evolutionists today are trying to, oh, no, no. Richard Dawkins said that he is an utterly committed Darwinist, but he's a social Christian. Because he understands what Darwinism means to the social fabric. And there's nothing to prevent any Christian from going to him and killing him. Except Christianity. But why would his enemy spare his life if Darwinism is true? And he knows it. Therefore, he's a social Christian. Oh, yes, yes. We need to keep the Christianity in the social fabric and treat each other with respect and not tell lies and things like that. Huh. Not according to Darwin. In fact, it's funny. Charles Darwin, he knew that evolution erased Christianity. He did not try to blend the two together. That's actually something I give him credit for. He was consistent, and he let his beliefs lead to their conclusion, which was atheism. All right, so let me ask you the question. If Charles Darwin was alive today, would he come up with a theory of natural selection leading to evolution? With all that we know about the complexity of life, could he have gotten away with it? Maybe. Would he have tried? Yeah, I do believe so. And I believe so because of Romans 8:7. The carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. You see that? For the unbeliever, they cannot accept the Bible. They cannot. Because to accept the Bible as true and know that hell exists and yet say, well, I'm not going to follow it, that's insanity. You can't do that. You have to deny it. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. The God of this age has blinded many people. Maybe not irrevocably, because I know what the gospel does to people. I know people even way up in the evolutionary establishment who have flipped over and changed. In fact, the man who wrote Genetic Entropy, that held up last night, John Sanford. Utter pagan. Humble follower of Christ today. Anthony Flew was the Richard Dawkins 20 years ago, most famous evolutionary atheist philosopher of the 20th century. He's not a Christian today, but he's not an evolutionist anymore either. He's become a theist, saying God must exist because of the evidence. So even God can knock someone off their highest pedestal. Yet at the same time, most people are walking around in a blind state. And we're called to witness to them, to shine light into their lives. I hope some of this which I've showed you might help you do that. Now notice, I didn't take Darwin and call him an idiot, because he wasn't. He was a brilliant man. I didn't call him a bad scientist. He made some mistakes, but his mistakes started from his assumptions. He didn't lie about stuff, as far as I know. He was a very detailed observer. And he, in fact, inside The Origin of Species, he wrote in there, here's a test of my theory. If this fails, my theory is wrong. He wrote that several times. Well, I've got to admire him for that. I don't dare do stuff like that. That's scary. Scientists don't do that. Because you might be proved wrong. And then what? You lose all your funding, etc., etc. Okay. Creation Magazine. Wonderful thing for everyone. Sign up on that form. I'm trying to get to something else here. Come on. There we go. Watch for the Darwin documentary. We will send out, anyone who's on InfoBytes or mailing list, we'll send out a blurb if it's going to play in your area on the television. And we'll send out a blurb if it's going to play to any church or university or any other public setting in your area so you can go see it. You might want to invite us back again and then rent a big hall in town and do lots of advertising and then we'll show this video. Remember, it's not necessarily a Christian video, but boy, it is extremely powerful. I can't tell you more than that because you have to see it. And I encourage you to pick up the Creation Answers book. That is the end. Thank you very, very, very much. I'm going to turn the podium back over. I'm going to step down.